From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Spotify rethinks its controversial effort to punish hate speech and hateful conduct among musicians that it streams. Then director Bart Layton's latest film tells the true story of the players behind an elaborate plan to steal rare books from a college library.
One of the real characters even says in the film, you know, there aren't exactly books out on how do you steal art. And so what they did was go to Blockbuster and rent every heist movie that you could find.
And teens and young adults on the autism spectrum take the stage in a musical they helped write. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and contemporary costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. While the TV industry continues to debate ABC's decision to cancel Roseanne Barr's show after she sent a racist tweet, the music industry is debating Spotify's policy toward what it calls hate speech and hateful conduct. Earlier this month, Spotify removed music by R. Kelly and XXXTentacion from its curated playlist. But there has been some backlash from within the industry, leading the streaming service to backtrack. Last night, Spotify CEO Daniel Ek addressed the issue at the Code Conference here in Southern California.
It was never about punishing one individual artist or even naming one individual artist as well. So I think, you know, and coming back to it, it's really kind of my responsibility as a leader. And I think we rolled this out wrong, and we could have done a much better job.
To discuss what Spotify's policy was and the industry's response to it, I called up Lucas Shaw in the Bloomberg newsroom.
Spotify was reacting to this Me Too moment in society by trying to both strip hate speech from its music service, but also penalize certain artists who'd been accused of conduct that it deemed hateful and show that it would no longer support or promote, in this case, two men who had been accused of all sorts of nasty things. R. Kelly, who has been trailed by claims of statutory rape for two decades, and XXXTentacion, who'd been accused of assaulting a pregnant woman. And so Spotify was still going to make it so that their music was available on the service, but it would not feature them on playlists, which is a really popular way to discover new music, nor would it promote them in any way. Spotify buys a lot of ads, does things like that with artists.
So there was a lot of reaction. A lot of it was negative. What was the essence of the backlash, and where did it come from?
It was primarily from record labels that felt blindsided by the move and questioned Spotify's kind of quote-unquote moral authority. They wondered why it was Spotify behaving this way. They thought it really should be up to them. And then policy was particularly controversial in the hip-hop community because Spotify had chosen to punish two prominent black artists, one of them a rapper, one of them an R&B singer, but who has worked with a lot of hip-hop artists, when there are all sorts of men who have been accused of violence towards women of many different races. And so there were 2 weeks of dialogue between the record industry and artists and Spotify. A lot of artists complained directly to Troy Carter, who's Spotify's main liaison to the artist community, as well as Daniel Ek, the CEO. I was told and reported last week that representatives for Kendrick Lamar, one of the, you know, the biggest rappers in the world, who was just handed a Pulitzer Prize, threatened to maybe boycott, which again may have been a bluff, but they wanted to communicate just how upset they were about the subjective nature of this policy.
So Spotify's CEO, Daniel Ek, spoke about all of this publicly for the first time on Wednesday. What did he have to say about what happened?
He said that the company bungled the rollout of it, that they didn't explain it clearly. There were a lot of people who interpreted it as Spotify taking their music off the service altogether, which is not what happened. And he realized that the optics, if you will, of punishing just those two artists also did not look good. He did try to walk it back a little bit in saying that the policy was designed for hate speech and that was it, which I found a little bit disingenuous since there was a whole other part of the policy that was about hateful conduct.
We're a platform where we want art. We want to express a lot of diverse opinions. We don't want to be the judge and the moral police of that.
And so what they'll do moving forward is a little unclear. Again, I reported last week that they were going to restore some of the music to playlists and that they had at least told the music community that they realized they screwed up and they were going to adjust the policy. But he didn't get into the details last night of just what they're going to do.
There was a very interesting question from the audience when Daniel Ek spoke, and it came from Hillary Rosen, who's the former head of the Recording Industry Association of America. And she asked Ek if he had lost his moral authority by backtracking. Is that the next iteration of this conversation?
Yeah, I think it's central to this whole conversation because they took up the moral authority upon themselves by instituting this policy. There were a lot of people confused about why they did it in the first place. Yes, there was growing clamor about R. Kelly and XXXTentacion, but nobody was saying it has to be Spotify, the one who acted. You know, Apple, which is a big music service, hasn't really done anything about it. YouTube, which is a popular music service, hasn't done anything about it. Amazon, which owns the music service, hadn't done anything about it. Spotify put itself out there and said, we are going to be a leader in this sense, and then because of the backlash from the music industry is now trying to walk it back a little bit, and to Ms. Rosen's point, surrendering a little bit of that authority. And so you wonder where they stand. They've created this no-win situation for themselves, unless they wanted to just stand by it and say, hey, we're on the right side of history with this, which I'm not sure they're going to do.
Finally, there's some breaking news about the Grammy Awards, and that is that Neil Portnow, the president and CEO of the Recording Academy for the last 16 years, that's the organization that presents the Grammys, is stepping down. And he's the guy who infamously said at the last Grammys that women need to step up if they wanted to be better represented. Is this expected, unexpected? What's your take from Portnow's news?
He is a pretty soft-spoken guy who got himself in a lot of trouble earlier this year. We've seen award shows like the Oscars and the Golden Globes try to improve the diversity of their nominees and of the presenters and of the performers. There has been less talk of the lack of diversity in the music business, but it's a very real problem. There have been a couple of reports showing kind of how few of the best-selling acts are women, and then in the case of the Grammys, how few of the nominees are women, how few of the performers are women, and Neil Portnow has not responded very well. So it's hard to believe that these two aren't related, given how long he's been running that organization.
Lucas Shaw covers entertainment, media, and technology at Bloomberg. Lucas, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, a film inspired by a real-life art heist that itself was inspired by heist movies. It's getting mighty meta in here.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. 14 years ago, four young men entered the library of a Kentucky college to steal some extremely valuable first editions of Audubon's Birds of America and Darwin's On the Origin of Species. But the amateur criminals botched the theft and ended up in federal prison. Now their story is told in the new film, American Animals.
I still don't understand how a book could be worth $12 million.
It's like if Picasso had a bunch of his paintings in a book.
When you say it's in the library, it's like what? Sitting on a shelf?
No, it's in the special collections room.
Which is what, like a vault?
More like a secure room with glass cases and stuff.
With guards on the doors and
No, but obviously you can't just walk in there.
American Animals is written and directed by the filmmaker Bart Layton. He's mostly known for making documentaries, such as The Imposter in 2012. In American Animals, he tells the story of the elaborate but poorly planned heist with a hybrid docu-narrative style. He weaves together interviews with the real robbers and has actors, including Barry Keoghan, playing the young men as they reenact their crime. When Leighton first heard about the story, he corresponded with the four thieves, who were then imprisoned in various institutions around the country. He was fascinated by how the men, who were highly educated and well-off, had collectively turned toward a life of crime. In a bizarre twist, they were inspired and informed by heist films, including Ocean's 12 and Reservoir Dogs, but the actual crime played out more like Dumb and Dumber. I spoke with Leighton last January in Park City at the Sundance Film Festival. Leighton was accompanied by some of the original criminals. They had since been released from prison for the film's Sundance premiere. And I started by asking Leighton what about this story captured his interest.
It wasn't your usual group of criminals. And so I wanted to understand more of the motivations for what they'd done. And that was really the spark for what would become the script that I started writing. One of them, Spencer, who's played by Barry Keoghan, he talked about dreaming of becoming an artist and feeling that the one thing he didn't have in his life, which all great artists need, is some experience of life and something traumatic or something tragic. And he felt that his life was sort of too perfect. And I guess I felt that what an amazingly unusual problem for a protagonist to have in a story, which is that his problem was that he didn't really have a problem.
And I think so, Eric said he needed a way to escape. Is that right?
Yeah, each of them had a sort of slightly different reason. I think Eric felt a little trapped in what he sort of described as a sterile suburban treadmill. You know, he was training to join the FBI. And I think he didn't feel that his heart was in it. And I think also he was motivated. You know, he was a bit of a loner and he wanted to be part of something.
There are so many different ways you could tell a story like this. One is kind of the purely documentary, old school way of using archival footage and interviews with witnesses. There's another version that's totally fictionalized and narrative. And then you choose a hybrid that seems almost perfect for the story because it's so much about who remembered what, how.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I'm glad you've noticed that. I mean, I think it was also a story about about people who were influenced by the movies and who were also struggling with the fact that they'd grown up with this expectation that their lives were going to be interesting and that they were going to be special and important, and slowly discovering that that's not how life turns out. And I also think, you know, one of the things that felt relevant to me is this idea that in order to be of value in this culture, you have to have some notoriety. To me, finding a way to reflect that in the form of the film, where you start in quite a naturalistic place, and as they get into the fantasy of trying to live inside a movie, so the grammar and the look of the film starts to change into that kind of movie, and we play with the tropes of, you know, the heist movies that they would have been watching.
Well, it's not just that they would have been watching, it's that they were watching. I mean, they were directly influenced by Reservoir Dogs, and if my memory serves, the day before they were arrested, they all went out to see Ocean's 12.
Yeah.
They were obsessed with heist movies and thought they could actually learn about how to do a heist from watching heist films.
One of the real characters even says in the film, you know, there aren't exactly books out on how do you steal art. And so what they did was go to Blockbuster and rent every heist movie that you could find. And I mean, you know, the irony being that most of those don't exactly end well.
The other thing that is fascinating to me is that Spencer, one of the real life thieves, was an artist, and he documented part of this thing in a, I don't know if it was a single piece or an installation called A Plan to Fail.
Yeah, it was one painting, yeah.
That the FBI used as a screensaver. What is A Plan to Fail, and what does that represent about his way of seeing himself in this story?
I think it comes down to this question about what the real motivation for doing this is. You know, did they plan to conduct a robbery in order to steal the works of art and sell them and get wealthy and go on the run or whatever it is? I'm not sure they even thought beyond that. Or really, was it about the fantasy of it? Was it about the escape from normal life? And I think, you know, what he meant by A Plan to Fail was that in the failure of the heist, what they got was possibly what they were looking for, a diversion from every expectation, every possible future outcome that was set out for them. They can't be lawyers and doctors anymore. They spent nearly 8 years in federal prison. What they got was something they didn't bargain for. I don't think they ever thought it was going to go well, but they kind of so desperately needed to see what was on the other side of the line you know, there's a point in the movie where you come to a kind of existential crossroads where you go one direction and it's a life of what they saw as predictable outcomes. And I'm not sure I agree with them, but that's what they saw. The other path leads to a place where nothing is guaranteed, where the only thing that's guaranteed is, you know, nothing will ever be the same again. And that's what they chose.
We're talking with Bart Layton. His new film is called American Animals. What does the title of the film mean to you?
Well, one of the books that was stolen was The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. And there's a passage in it which talks about American animals and how they had receded to the Kentucky caves over centuries. And it felt sort of appropriate in that there's a tie-in with the art that they steal, which is The Origin of Species, but also Birds of America by John James Audubon was one of the most valuable books on the planet. And also this question about young men in search of some kind of experience of life and, I guess, exposing their animal side.
How important is it that what they're stealing is beautiful? That it's not just Audubon's books. It is the beautiful writing of Darwin. It's another, I think, illuminated manuscript called Hortus Anastasis, that they're stealing rare books, but they're also rare books that have great beauty inside of them.
I think that differs from the perspective of each of the characters. I think for Spencer, who was the artist, these were deeply beautiful and inspirational books. You know, here's a guy who's looking for his way of expressing himself as an artist, and there he sees Audubon, who was also a young man who lived in Kentucky, who was in business and then one day gave it all up to go into the wilderness. And I think this was Spencer's version of a trip into the wilderness. This was his way of confronting himself with his own kind of animal nature, I guess. And I think it was. And now, as an artist, one of the things that he's most interested in is paintings of birds and nature. And he's a member of the Audubon Society. And I think for the others, it really wasn't about the beauty of the art. I think it was about the fact that it was about having a target for a heist and the heist being an escape from everything else.
One of the trickiest things about bringing a film like this to any festival is that if the real subjects are part of the team that's coming to Park City, you can't quite bring them up on stage because it's not as if they deserve applause for committing a crime. So how awkward is their presence at the festival? It's their story. They're sharing their story with an audience. And yet, in a way, they can't really be recognized because they can't be. It would just be odd, I guess.
Yeah, it would be inappropriate. I think they served their time. They are deeply remorseful. I think you see that in the film. I was grateful to them that they allowed us to tell their story and that they were as honest as they were, because I think it's really clear to everyone that it's a cautionary tale. One of the things that people kept coming up afterwards and saying was, you know, this is the most unbelievable roller coaster ride of a film, but it should be shown in prisons and schools because it's like a great advert for,
like, Scared Straight.
Yeah,
too.
I guess so. Yeah, I think they all found it hard to watch. You know, it was a difficult thing to go through. It was deeply, it was difficult for their parents, but I think, you know, they all agreed that it was very true to their experience.
And how is Betty Jean Gooch, who is the librarian who is protecting these materials, it must have been incredibly traumatic for her. I would not be surprised if she's suffered greatly in its aftermath.
Yeah, I think for her it was also really cathartic. I think she was initially reticent to be involved and then realized, you know, where we were coming from and what kind of a film we wanted to make. You know, and I was nervous showing it to her. You know, she's the victim. For us, she is the only person really who we feel has to be happy with it. And if she had objected, then I probably would have thought about going back into the edit. But she said that she found it a very accurate account. Suddenly, for the first time, she said she felt she was able to understand them a little bit better and actually find some forgiveness for them. You know, Ann Dowd plays her, and she happens to be a huge Ann Dowd fan, which helps a lot. And Ann Dowd was amazing. And Ann was also really respectful because, you know, the real Betty Jean is, you know, an amazing lady, actually. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that that came through.
Bart Layton, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, man. It's been a pleasure.
I'm American Animals opens in theaters on June 1st. Coming up, we visit a theater program that caters to teens and young adults who have autism. Welcome back to The Frame. Kobe Bird may only be 16 years old, but he already has his Screen Actors Guild card and some pretty impressive roles, including a guest starring part on ABC's The Good Doctor. Bird credits a program called The Miracle Project with his success. The project brings young people with autism, like Bird, together with people of all abilities to write and perform an original musical. Their latest show is called 185 Wilshire, and it goes up this weekend. KPCC Arts Education reporter Carla Javier met up with actor Kobe Bird during a rehearsal.
Rules are late. Let me process what I want to say. Maybe you should think before you speak and talk to me that way. Hey, I stutter, say it uninfectively. But I'm a star, I record, it's not affecting me. I was bullied and shunned, no one accepted me. But listen to me, check the marquee and be expecting it.
Watching Kobe Bird rapping confidently during a rehearsal, you'd have no reason to believe he's any different than any other actor. And that's kind of the point.
I am an iceberg floating in the water. Look a little deeper, try a little harder. Might take a little time, but you'll like what you find. There is a lot to us. Autism may stop at us. Autism may stop at us.
Kobe has autism. People with autism can sometimes have trouble communicating and being comfortable in social interactions. His mom, Rachel Bird, remembers when he was diagnosed with a developmental disorder when he was 4.5 years old.
His language wasn't good. He was tantruming constantly. He was having a really hard time, and we didn't know what he'd be able to do.
When he was 11, he tried acting for the first time.
He was a step together in the background kind of kid, and he was happy doing that. I was happy seeing him just up there. I wasn't sure how he would do, and I didn't know how he was going to follow direction.
That's when things changed for Kobe and when he met Elaine Hall. Hall founded the Miracle Project inspired by her experiences as an on-set acting coach for young actors and then as a mom to a son with autism. Hall tells Kobe she saw something special in him in those early days.
I just remember how disciplined you were and focused you were and how hard you tried and added things to the role. And I thought, this is really an amazing kid.
So Coach E invited Kobe to join a more advanced class, which was an anti-bullying play at the Wallace.
What was your role?
A bully. I was a bully, yeah. My first big, role.
How did you feel about playing a bully?
I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a bully. This is wrong because I don't want people to think that I really am a bully and that I'm actually really mean because I don't want to do that. So I told Coach E, I don't want to be a bully at all.
This was really personal for Kobe. When he was in school,
a lot of the kids in my class were actually bullying me because I had autism, so that was very hard for me.
And Coach E said, Kobe, this is you acting, and this is you showing what people shouldn't do.
So he thought about it, and he did it. He played a bully.
You know, being a bully was hard for me, but you know, I used all my experience in being bullied, and I put it out on that, and I showed what people did to me.
This year's show is called 185 Wilshire. The actors and their mentors started writing it last fall by doing improv and talking about their experiences looking for love. And without spoiling too much, Kobe plays a character named Dean.
He's the leader of this group of friends, and he's all the girls love him. Like he's so slick back and just so calm, so enthusiastic, so cool.
And even though in his free time Kobe prefers to listen to Frank Sinatra, Ray Charles, and J-pop, in this show, his character raps without missing a beat.
We're more than historical perceptions. We're more than all of your misconceptions. You can generalize, but realize I am a walking and talking exception. We're more than a cure, more than a fix. More like we're the solution. It takes the eyes of an unseen view to sow the seeds of a new revolution.
Can you explain that a little bit?
I want people to understand that, we don't want you to just say, oh, I accept you. We want you to show, prove to us that you accept us.
For Kobe, the Miracle Project is about more than just the autism that brought them all together. Not only are he and his fellow cast members learning important lessons about the arts.
Like for singing, you can't sing with your throat, singing your diaphragm, your stomach.
They're also gaining valuable life skills, like how to deal with change, which is something that can be difficult for people who have autism.
It's a professional theater group, and anybody in theater knows that in tech or even different nights of the shows, something can change. They can say, oh, we're not going to put this in, we're going to put that in. And to see them take that change and take the direction and be able to do it and apply it is pretty brilliant, something I never knew my son would be able to do.
Kobe doesn't just do all of this for fun. It's actually his job. After performing with the Miracle Project, Kobe was noticed by talent managers and landed real paying gigs on The Good Doctor and Speechless, playing characters with autism. His mom says he even has an agent now.
Watching Kobe go from a kid who watched movies to a kid who is now making movies and making TV shows and on stage and telling stories is amazing.
Kobe says the supportive environment at the Miracle Project made all of this possible.
Everyone was just so accepting of me and not like telling me I couldn't do this, because with that it gave me the confidence in it. And it made me come out of my shell and tell me I can do this. I can talk more. I can sing more. I can be social more. And that's, they show me it's okay to have autism.
His next goal, landing a role playing a character without autism. For The Frame, I'm Carla Javier.
The Miracle Project's original production, 185 Wilshire, runs June 1st through the 3rd at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Beverly Hills. And we close today with this. The furor around Roseanne Barr's tweets and the cancellation of her show continues to rage. And now another firestorm has broken out over a vulgar and sexist comment Samantha Bee made last night on her show.
Ivanka Trump, who works at the White House, chose to post the second most oblivious tweet we've seen this week. You know, Ivanka, that's a beautiful photo of you and your child. But let me just say, one mother to another, do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless. He listens to you.
B and her network, TBS, have apologized for her comment, but it's unlikely that this controversy will calm down anytime soon. Many people are calling for her show to meet the same fate as Roseanne's, and some advertisers are dropping their sponsorship of B. Stay tuned. And that is it for today's show. You can keep up with us on Twitter at The Frame. You can also find me there at JG Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.